紧缺人才培训工程教学系列丛书，英语高级口语资格证书考试，高级听力教程第二版，周国强、杨永平主编，由上海外语音像出版社录制出版。第三盒
An Advanced Course of English Listening Second Edition。
Part 4, Volvo Earnings. Volvo earnings rise by 11% in first quarter. Volvo, the Swedish automotive energy and food group, increased its profits by 10.9% in the first quarter of this year despite a fall of 5% in group turnover. Profits after financial items rose to 2.4 billion Swedish krona, $345 million,compared with 2.21 billion Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. The group was helped by a 215 million Swedish krona foreign exchange gain on loans, compared with a gain of 30 million Swedish krona a year earlier, as well as by interest earnings of 109 million Swedish krona, compared with 77 million Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. Operating profits were virtually unchanged,at 2.13 billion Swedish krona compared with 2.1 billion Swedish krona in the first quarter of last year. Volvo expects to make a productivity gain this year of at least 5%. The group's liquid funds, inflated by the record profits of the past 2 years, climbed to 18.25 billion Swedish krona by the end of the first quarter from 14.4 billion Swedish krona a year earlier.Volvo profits, at least in the short term, have been hedged against the impact of the falling dollar, but the lower dollar exchange rate shows clearly in the group's sales figures. Volvo turnover fell 5% to 20.6 billion Swedish krona from 21.8 billion Swedish krona in the first 3 months of last year, despite a substantial rise in the volume of car sales.
Part 5. Days and Times.Have you ever called a place for help or information and gotten a recording? What was the place? What did the recording say? Many businesses use recordings to save time and money, especially after office hours. You are going to hear several recordings of this type. After each recording, fill in the missing information. This is Pacific Telephone. Our business office is open 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.We are closed weekends and holidays. If you need repair service, please call 611. If you need new service, please refer to your local directory for the phone center nearest you. Thank you. You have reached the electric company emergency service. Our regular telephone business hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If this is an emergency, please stay on the line. Your call will be handled in the order received.Thank you for calling the Music Center Information Line. Our hours are 9 to 6 p.m., Monday through Saturday, and Sundays from 12 to 6 p.m. This is the correct number for information on all events at the Music Center, except the Bell Theater. For the Bell Theater, call 972-7654. For more information, stay on the line. Your call will be answered shortly. Thank you.This is the Auto Club After Hours Emergency Center. For travel and weather information, please call during regular business hours between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m., Monday through Friday. For emergency roadside service, please hold on. A counselor will be available soon. This is University Hospital information. Most offices are closed now. To reach hospital emergency services, dial 825-1491. For emergency police service, dial 825-1411. For hospital patient information, dial 825-8611. For other hospital information, dial 825-9111. Part 6. Listening and Translation. A. Sentence translation.
1. When you answer the telephone in a private house, it is usual to say the telephone number as soon as you lift the receiver.
2. It's staying cloudy tonight with a 40% chance of rain or drizzle. And tomorrow it's going to start dry with bright spells.
3. You'll have 2 nights in Cairo with a chance to see the pyramids and then a relaxing cruise on the luxurious Nile steamer.
4. Women in almost all jobs are less stressed and cope better than their male colleagues.
5. Reports are coming in of an earthquake in a small town 50 miles north of Sydney, and damages is said to be expensive.
B. Passage translation.
1. Demographic changes will probably have an adverse effect on the market in the future. The population is aging, and it's likely that this will have a negative influence. The 21 to 30 age group are traditionally heavy users of sun creams, and this group is declining in numbers. Also, usage is very low among the 50-plus age groups, and these groups are expanding.
2. As you can see, we've been able to reduce this budget and still improve our turnover. Our experiment with TV shots 4 years ago did not lead to significantly higher sales. Since then, we have been steadily raising the proportion of spending devoted to press advertising. This enables us to target consumers with high incomes who will be more likely to take holidays abroad. Unit 6. Part 1. A new job. Hello, Woolworths.
Ah, hello. I wonder if I could speak to the personnel manager, please.
Yes, certainly. If you'll hold on a minute, I'll put you through.
Thank you.
Hello, John Adams speaking.
Ah, good morning, Mr. Adams. I saw your advertisement in the Saffron Walden Reporter for a hostess. Oh, yes, and I wondered if you could give me a few more details about the job.
Yes, certainly. Perhaps I should make it clear from the start, it is a part-time job. Yes, we would need you from 10 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, roughly.
Yes, yes. I didn't realize that, actually. It wasn't clear in the advertisement.
Uh-huh. Are you still interested?
Well, I am interested, but it would depend to some extent on what the salary is.
Yes. Well, we're offering about £75 a week.
Yes.
Obviously, this may be a little bit more if you have the right qualifications and experience.
Hmm.
Have you, in fact, had any experience in catering?
Well, yes, I have. I'm at present working for and have been working for the same firm for about 5 years, for a small firm of, consultant engineers.
Mm, yeah.
And I've been doing work rather similar to the kind of work that I think, is described in the advertisement.
Yes, well, I mean we have a fairly small staff here. We're talking about 15 to 20 people.
Yes.
So your duties will be sort of to prepare and serve the food at just at lunchtimes.
I see. Yes. I'm sure I'd be able to manage that. That wouldn't be a problem.
Yes. Well, that sounds about right. Perhaps you could come down for an interview sometime?
Yes, yes. When will be suitable for you?
Let me just have a look at my diary. Yes. Perhaps, what about next Wednesday at about 2:30 in the afternoon? Would that be all right for you?
Wednesday, 2:30. Yes, I think that will be fine, actually. That's okay.
Ah, good. Yeah, and perhaps you could bring any qualifications you've got, so we could have a look at them, and,
Yes, okay.
Could you just tell me who you're working for at the moment?
I'm working for, bloggers, actually, in the high street.
Right, okay. And could I just have your name?
Yes, my name. My surname is Boardman. That's B-O-A-R-D-M-A-N.
Yeah.
And my initial is S.
Right. Okay. S. Boardman.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, Miss Boardman. Well, see you then next Wednesday at 2:30.
Okay. Thanks very much, then.
Lovely. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Part 2. A job as a veterinary surgeon.
Mr. Mercer, what is your job exactly?
I'm a veterinary surgeon in general practice, looking after all different sorts of animals. Sheep, goats, pigs, horses, dogs, cats. We do have some lions and tigers at the zoo. We have a few bears, wolves, otters. You name it, we look after it.
What sort of pets do people bring you here to your surgery mainly?
Well, mostly it's going to be dogs and cats. But then we have snakes and parrots and rats and ferrets and all the other animals that people keep as pets.
You mentioned snakes. Why do you think people keep snakes? What's the attraction in that?
Well, I quite like snakes, but I wouldn't actually want one as a pet. I think they keep them to frighten other people with, really. No, some people are very keen on snakes. They like having them.
What do you find attractive about snakes?
They're all muscle. They're not sort of slimy as people think. They're all muscle. Fairly powerful. We do have some problems. One or two of the smaller ones will snap at you, but in general it's the big crushing snakes that we deal with. We had one in here one day that was 13 feet long. It took three of us to lift it. Now if that gets around you twice, wrapped around you a couple of times, then you really are in for a good hug.
Now the British people have a reputation for being very animal-minded. Do you think the British spend more money on their animals than their children?
It depends on the people. Some people are very good with their animals. Some people are reasonable with their animals. Some go absolutely over the top and treat them far better than they would their children. And unfortunately, there are a group of people that are cruel to their animals. And so we do a certain amount of work with the Royal RSPCA.
What experience have you had of people who treat their animals too well?
Lots of animals come in for surgery with lipstick marks on their head. We regard that as a specific sort of condition here, and we always make a comment on it.
And do you think animals are good for people's health?
Well, of late, we now talk about companion animals rather than pets, and certainly people are taking dogs and cats into hospitals, to old people's homes, where a social contact is needed, and this sort of patting of animals seems to help old people. And certainly, we have old people who have budgerigars and other small animals, and they're very much their life. They maybe see one person every 2 days, but their animals are with them all the time, and it's a companion.
Do animals ever attack you when you're handling them?
Mostly, we handle them very easily. It's only occasionally that we get hurt by animals, scratched and bitten by cats, bitten by dogs, and my partner recently got very badly hurt by a horse. So we have a dangerous job as well as an enjoyable job. I think probably the thing I like best about it is delivering new animals. It never fails to amaze me how one moment you can have one mother and the next moment you can have a pile of animals. And I think the day I don't get pleasure out of delivering newborn animals, I shall give up.
But you're still very much interested in your job.
Oh, love it. Love it. I would like a lot less paperwork. And I'd like just to do veterinary and medicine. But unfortunately, you take on a sort of package.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed.
Part 3. A Day in the Life of.
Extract 1. The Cleaner. I start work at... I come into work at 8 o'clock, and the first thing I do is collect my keys. Then I go down to the common room. I sleep and I wash the floor, and I also check the toilets, and when there's no students in the classrooms, I empty the bins and do the rooms, and I also help over the canteen when the girl is off to do teas and coffees, and usually sweep the stairs and then wash them again, and I leave off at 2 o'clock. What I particularly hate is having to be at work at a certain time, and leave off at a certain time, and have to work to a pattern all the while. And I also do hate cigarette ends and dirty tissues about the floor. I think there's nothing more degrading than somebody having to pick a dirty tissue up that someone's used, and also to pick cigarette ends up that have been in other people's mouths. If I was to get paid for every dog end I pick up, I would be a rich lady. What I like about my job is I'm free and easy. I work on my own, and so if I want to do something this day, I do it. And if I want to do something the next day, I do it. I find the students very, very friendly. They will come and talk to you in their breaks or any spare time, and they will tell you all about their country, and it's very, very interesting.
Extract 2. A sales representative. The hours really aren't very regular, although I work every day of the week, Monday to Friday. But I don't start at 9 till 5. That sort of hours because I don't work in an office. I work from home. Having said that, some of the hours can be from 7 in the morning till 10 at night, depending on if I get a lot of phone calls during the week. So, having had the phone calls, I've got to go out and see them all over the place, and for that, obviously, I've got to have a car, which the company supplies. All expenses. Some of the people that I go to see are quite awkward. There are a lot of men. It's a very male-oriented business, and a lot of men still feel that a woman's place is in the home, and she should be tied to the kitchen sink and looking after the children. Any candidate who comes for my type of job has to be outgoing, fairly joyful, cheerful. They've got to be constantly smiling, eyes bright, questions answered, and it's not the easiest of situations if you've had a heavy session the night before.
Extract 3. A policeman. I don't really have a typical day. All days are different, but on a day for me at work, it will be typical for me to go into my office, 8 o'clock, and liaise with other people who I work with in my office. On commencing the patrol of my area, the other thing I've got to keep my eye out open for is anything unusual in the area. Any abandoned motor vehicles that may have been stolen from somewhere else, or indeed anything else that should need my attention. It also involves being seen in shopping areas, areas of schools, busy crossroads, and speaking, as I say, generally speaking to people, going into shops and finding out if they've got any problems or complaints. Another part of my job is, it doesn't just revolve around crime, it does also involve traffic regulations. So there are several ways you can go about that job without always having to take the person before the courts. Warnings are often given. You don't want to, as an area community PC, it's not wise to upset unnecessarily the people who you want to help in order to do your job. This, you've got to be conscious all the time, and it takes quite a lot of skill.
Part 4. The Changing U.S. Job Market. High school and college students in the United States today, as well as others who plan to work in this country, have one important question about their futures. Will they find a job? There is no easy answer, of course, but let's look at some of the recent changes in the U.S. job market and see if we can make some prediction for future job hunters. A good way to begin is to look at the American workforce and how it's changing. The most important change has been the shift from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. Let's define both of these terms. First, a service economy is one in which most workers provide services. That is, they do something, like pumping gas into people's cars, for example, instead of making something. Generally, service jobs are grouped into 5 categories. 1. Transportation and utility companies, like the phone company. 2. Wholesale companies. 3. Retail companies. 4. Finance, insurance, and real estate companies. And finally, 5. Personal services, such as hotels, car repair, accounting, and medicine. Examples of people who work in service industries include your doctor, your hairstylist, airline pilots, and sales clerks in department stores. In contrast, people who actually produce things, like cars, furniture, or clothing, are part of the manufacturing economy. Now, the point here is that we have changed from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. The following numbers will show you just how much our economy has changed. 100 years ago, 80% of workers produced goods. Today, only about 30% do. Economists predict that by the year 2000, 9 out of every 10 workers will supply services. What has caused this change in our economy? Well, first, manufacturing industries are not growing for one simple reason: competition from Western Europe and Asia. Jobs in American automobile and steel production have especially decreased during the last 10 years. The number of service industries, on the other hand, has increased for several reasons. Because of technological advances, especially in computers and telephone communications, advertising, accounting, and other business services become important. Also, the growing number of married women who work outside the home has increased the need for restaurants and daycare centers. And, as the number of old people has grown, so have healthcare services. So now you know where the jobs will be, and you've decided to look for a job in a service industry. But wait, because some economists worry that the service job explosion may create several problems. According to some studies, American standard of living might decrease because half of the service jobs pay low wages. For example, 3 out of 5 new jobs between 1979 and 1985 paid less than $7,000 a year. The pay is low because many of these jobs don't require much education or training, and many of the workers are part-time or temporary employees. Companies save money by using temporary employees because they don't have to give them health insurance or vacation pay. Such jobs give a worker very little security. The good news is that, as you can see in the chart, the fastest growing service job categories are the better paying ones, particularly in the technological and computer-related fields. But these jobs require a high degree of skill and many years of education. So if you decide to look for a job in a service industry and you want to be sure you'll make enough money, getting the right training and education first is the best way to prepare for the future job market.
Part 5. This Proud Land.
The trees that burn down to the ground.
Part 6. Listening and Translation. A. Sentence Translation.
1. Despite several interventions by the Bank of Japan, the yen rose during the week amid a lack of fresh dollar buying incentive.
2. Bank of Indonesia, the central bank of the country, declared over the weekend that it will stop using 5 kinds of banknotes.
3. This is the most serious hurricane to have hit the Pacific Island in the past 10 years, and we'll give you the details as they come in.
4. When it is completed, the port will have an annual handling volume of 10 million tons of cargo.
5. Police figures show that computer crimes are on the increase, with 98 reported so far this year, compared with 37 in 1998 and 72 in 1999.
B. Passage Translation.
1. The pay negotiations were going badly. We wanted to link the pay increase to the productivity level, but the unions refused. They wouldn't budge. We finally reached a point where they were threatening to go on strike. We sacked all the employees. We sent out letters to everyone saying that their employment would cease on a certain date. Then we offered them new employment contracts which linked a pay rise with productivity. One by one, they all gave in and signed on the dotted line.
2. I had a terrible stock control problem with one of the shop managers. I used to say, look, I don't want your stock in the stockroom. I want it on the shelves. But he never listened. He had a huge stockroom, and every shelf was full. Anyway, one day I'd had enough, so I got hold of a carpenter, and I boarded up his stockroom. You should have heard the screams. But that shop ran like clockwork after that.
Unit 7. Part 1. London. London, capital of England, is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world. With its population of Indians, Pakistanis, Bangladeshis, Africans, West Indians, Cypriots, Chinese, and many more, it is in some ways as much a Commonwealth city as British city. And it is, of course, an international center for tourism. The tourist season in London, which used to be mainly in the summer months, is now all year round. And of the 15 million people who visit Britain each year, most spend at least a few days in London. But London is more than this. It is the center of government and the home of the Queen. It is also the financial center of Britain. When people talk about the city, they are referring not to London itself, but to a small area called the City of London. The City of London contains the Stock Exchange, the Bank of England, and all the major financial institutions. London was originally established by the Romans, who chose the site of Londonium for its good trading and defensive position. When the Romans left, Winchester became the capital of England until the 13th century, when administration was moved to London. London's growth in the Middle Ages brought overcrowding, lack of sanitation, and unhealthy conditions. Outbreaks of bubonic plague, the Black Death, were very common. In 1666, the Great Fire of London destroyed much of the city. Many of London's finest buildings date from the subsequent period of intensive planning and rebuilding. St. Paul's Cathedral is only one example. The 18th and 19th centuries saw London's growth as an international center of trade and finance. During the 20th century, London's international importance had declined. Today, it has to compete as a financial center with New York, Tokyo, and other major capitals. Part 2. Taxis in Great Britain. There are about 56,000 licensed taxis in Great Britain, mainly in urban areas. London has about 17,500. In London and several other major cities, taxis must be purpose-built to conform to very strict requirements, and new ones have to provide for people in wheelchairs. In many urban districts, drivers must have passed a test of their knowledge of the area. At present, a local authority can only limit the number of licensed taxis if it is satisfied that there is no unfulfilled demand for taxis in its area. Private hire vehicles with drivers may be booked only through the operator and not hired on the street. In most areas outside London, private hire vehicles are licensed. The government launched a review of the taxi licensing regime in England and Wales in October 1993. There are about 4,000 licensed taxis in Northern Ireland. Licenses are issued by the Department of the Environment for Northern Ireland on a basis broadly similar to that in Great Britain. 1. About how many licensed taxis are there in Great Britain? 2. How many licensed taxis are there in London? 3. Which of the following statements is true about all taxis in London and other major cities? 4. Which of the following statements is true about taxi drivers in many urban areas? 5. Which of the following statements is true about private hire vehicles with drivers? 6. When did the government make a review of the taxi licensing regime in England and Wales? 7. About how many licensed taxis are there in Northern Ireland?
Part 3. About the London taxi driver.
The law on taxis is very interesting, and I know in London it's different from other places, and rules are quite strict, aren't they?
Any London cab driver does a thing called the knowledge, which is an examination, really. It's called the knowledge, and it's a basic test of 468 runs. what they call runs, from a blue book.
And the idea is that anybody can get into a taxi anywhere in London and give the driver a destination, and he's got to know the way there.
That's the basis of the knowledge, finding anywhere from point A to B in that 6-mile radius in London.
Is it difficult to learn the knowledge?
Average, it took me 19 months. Now it's taking guys 3 years because they want. I mean, you've got to have a medical, you're checked out by the police, you do the knowledge, but after you've done the basic knowledge, there's still more advanced to do. It can take anywhere, now, from 2 to 3 years. And then you do a driving test at the end.
I get the impression they're very strict about taxis. Quite apart from the knowledge, there's the license. Do you have to have a license every year?
The license is renewed 3 years. But for your cab, whether you rent it or you own it, has to have a yearly overhaul, which is a very strict passing test, and there are some real stringent tests it's got to pass.
Is it really worth it all?
Yeah, I think it's worth it. I enjoy being a taxi driver, and not only that, it does keep the standard very high, which is what we want in London.
Do you feel proud to be a Londoner? Were you born in London?
No. I was actually born in Bristol, but I came up to London when I was 12.
Do you think of yourself as a Bristolian or a Londoner?
A few people think I'm still a country boy, because I've still got that accent in me. I haven't really got a typical London Cockney accent, but I see myself as a Londoner, definitely now, because I've been up here a lot longer.
What do you do in your spare time?
Well, I'm into bodybuilding. That takes up quite a good deal of my spare time, basically.
How much time?
I might do a system of 3 days training with a day off, followed by another 3 days training and a day off.
Where do you go to train?
I train at Ultra Sport Gym. That's up in Norwood.
Forgive my ignorance, but are we talking about some of Mr. Universe here? With you standing up in front of an audience and playing music and putting oil on your body and all that sort of thing? Is that the kind of bodybuilding you do?
Well, when you get seriously into the sports, you are literally building your body. All areas of your body. So on a Monday, for example, you might just train your chest with your triceps. And on the Tuesday you might, I don't know, your back and legs. You split your body up.
It's just weights, or do you have a lot of gadgets?
We've got machines up there, but it's not a high gloss, you know, sort of fitness center that you see some other gyms have got. It's a lot of free weights.
Do you have somebody supervising your training?
No. I train with 2 other regular partners. Part 4. An American in London.
What were the things in Britain that you found most strange when you first arrived?
Well, the first thing is driving on the wrong side of the road. That was very strange, because you have this automatic reflex when you go out into the street to look one way, and a couple of times I did that, and I almost got hit by cars and bikes and all. You know, it's dangerous. It really is dangerous. And you have to teach yourself to look the other way.
Someone said that Britain and the United States are divided by a common language. Have you had any difficulties with the language here?
Oh, yeah. Tremendous amount of difficulty. But I'm starting to pick it up now. All the lingo and slang and all those. But there's definitely a difference.
Can you give me any examples?
Well, the big... I'd say some of the biggest ones would be the word queue, which means in America, line. I never heard the word queue before. What do you call chips? I call French fries. I never heard them called chips. There's so many. Words that are different. Crisps, which means potato chips. Yeah, we call them potato chips, or chips, in America. You call them crisps here. So, when I heard the word chips, I was thinking of crisps and not French fries. You know, it's very confusing. But just some of the expressions like, mate, you know, and love.
Those, you know, they're funny. You don't hear them. You don't hear them in America.
What about with young people? With people your own age, I mean. Do you notice differences there?
I do notice some differences. I think the younger people in Britain are... They seem to be much more radical than the younger people in the United States. I noticed that. The dress is different. You see a lot of... I see a lot of males here with earrings in one of their ears. You don't see that in America that much. Maybe here and there, but not like you see it here. So many of the young people wear black clothing, you know. You don't see the other colors. At home you see all different types of bright colors. And in England you see so much black, especially on the women.
You don't like that?
Not really. It's just my own preference. I'd rather see different colors here and there. Not all one color. Everyone looks like Madonna.
When you say radical, are you just thinking of clothes or anything else?
No. I think radical as in going against the norms, could you say. Not only in clothing, but I think in politics too. Whereas in America, you don't find that as much. Oh, also another difference is the younger people are, they're more politically aware on a larger level. See, a lot of the Americans, they're aware of the government of the United States and maybe a few other countries, but not as many countries in Europe, or they just have a vague understanding of how those other countries are run, not as widespread. Whereas here, I think that the kids get to know about how different countries are run at a much younger level, and they know all about the United States and how it's run.
What do you think the reasons are for that?
That's a good question. I think that the reasons are just because of the press. You hear so much about America here that people are, they're into it. They want to know what it's about and how it's run. And so many of our policies in America affect Britain, that they want to understand how policies are made and all that. And seeing that doesn't work on the other level, like Britain's policies don't, I mean, they can affect us, but not to as great an extent, and therefore you don't hear as much about Britain, and people don't know as much about it.
Part 5. The Civil Rights Movement in the USA. The 1950s and 1960s were years of great struggle for black Americans. Although slavery had been abolished in 1863, segregation in the 1950s, the separate and unequal treatment of blacks by whites, was still the custom in the northern part of the United States. In the southern states, it was the law. As an example, suppose you were a black citizen in Montgomery, Alabama, in 1954. A simple bus ride into town could be very frustrating. When the bus stopped for you, you paid the driver in front of the bus. However, as a black person, you were not allowed to sit in the front. The front was for whites only. So, after paying the driver, you had to get off the bus, walk to the back, enter at the rear door, and sit down in the back. What happened if the front of the bus was full and more white passengers got on? Well, you had to give up your seat in the back and ride standing. That was the law. On Thursday, December 1st, 1955, something important happened. On the day, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a middle-aged black woman, refused to give up her seat to a white man. The bus driver called the police, and she was arrested. This one small event helped change the direction of American history. It also marked the beginning of the career of the most famous black American leader, Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. was a young minister in a black church in Montgomery. When he heard about Mrs. Parks' arrest, he, along with other black leaders in the city, decided to protest it. They organized a boycott of the buses for one day. That is,
Every black person in Montgomery was asked to stay off the buses for one full day. The boycott was a complete success. Because about 70% of the bus company's customers were black, the buses drove almost empty all day long. Later that day, black leaders decided to continue the boycott until the company promised black riders better treatment. As the boycott went on with Dr. King as its leader, the white people of Montgomery became more and more upset and angry. Dr. King was put in jail and beaten, and his house was bombed. But throughout all this, Martin Luther King told his people to meet violence with nonviolence, and to meet hate with love. Because of his powerful message of nonviolence, no one was killed during the entire year of the boycott. Finally, in 1965, the United States Supreme Court said it was illegal to segregate blacks and whites on buses, trains, or planes. Martin Luther King had taught his people a new way to win their rights. After the bus boycott, the use of nonviolent protests against segregation became popular throughout the South. Dr. King led many peaceful marches against segregation in restaurants, movie theaters, and other public places. On August 28, 1963, the biggest march of all was held. More than 1 million people from all parts of the country, black and white, young and old, marched on Washington, D.C. They wanted Congress to pass a national law against segregation and discrimination. At that meeting, Dr. King gave one of the most famous speeches in American history. In it, he talked about his hopes for America and the world. "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, right down in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. So let freedom ring. When we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, 'Free at last, free at last, great God Almighty, we're free at last.'" 2 years after Dr. King gave this famous speech, one of his goals was achieved. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 became a new law that made it illegal to segregate blacks or other minorities or discriminate against them. In the same year, Martin Luther King also received the Nobel Peace Prize. His work was far from finished, however. He continued to fight for civil rights not only in the South, but also in northern cities like Chicago and Detroit, which had large numbers of unemployed black workers. His message was still one of nonviolence, although some young black leaders no longer accepted it as a way to win equality. Many did not believe in Dr. King's way of love and peace. In 1968, violent riots broke out in New York, Detroit, and Los Angeles, poisoning the air of the country with hatred and violence. The horrible climax came on April 4, 1968, when Martin Luther King Jr. was shot to death by a white man. Thanks to Dr. King and the civil rights movement, black Americans and other minorities have won many rights in the last 30 years. Today, no shop owner can legally refuse to accept a customer because of a race. Public facilities must be made available to all people. Schools can no longer be for white children only. Segregation has been made illegal. But have prejudice and discrimination completely disappeared from our society? Not at all. The struggle against them continues. Part 6. Listening and Translation. A. Sentence Translation.
1. Only in this way can enterprises have strong competitiveness to vie with their domestic and overseas counterparts.
2. Share prices fluctuated narrowly in surprisingly thin trading volume after the long holiday.
3. Australia has long been a major exporter of raw materials to the world, but it is now looking to make a name for itself as an exporter of high technology.
4. The construction of the factory will start by the end of this year and production in June 2005.
5. Shanghai is a world-famous city. Shanghai has been a window to the West. It is the city in which my country and yours issued the communique that began our modern friendship.
B. Passage Translation.
1. A hotel is a temporary home for people who are traveling. In a hotel, the traveler can rest and has access to food and drink, either on the premises or nearby. The hotel may also offer facilities for recreation, such as a swimming pool, a golf course, or a beach. In many cases, the hotel also provides brief space for the traveler's means of transportation, which nowadays is the automobile. All of these services are designed to accommodate the traveler, so the hotel business is often referred to as the accommodations industry.
2. Here's a job possibly for somebody who's a school leaver. It requires no experience at all, but training will be given on the job, and the pay is $280 a week. What's the job? Well, it's a shop assistant in a busy supermarket. It's a full-time job, but the big thing is you don't need any experience. So if you're just leaving school and fancy working in a supermarket, try that. You get one day off during the week, and you must work one late evening till 9:30 p.m. Okay? So, that's a shop assistant. Well, if you fancy any of these jobs, give us a ring here at Radio Southwest.
Unit 8. Part 1. How the British spend their holidays. Nearly all British people in full-time jobs have at least 4 weeks holiday a year, often in 2 or 3 separate periods. The normal working week is 35 to 40 hours, Monday to Friday. People who have to work in shifts with unsocial hours are paid extra for the inconvenience. More overtime is worked at extra pay than in most other Western European countries, but there is relatively little moonlighting, that is, independent work for pay in leisure hours. Another way of saying this is that the black economy, involving work paid privately in cash and not officially recorded or taxed, is relatively small. There are only 8 official public holidays a year, only one of them in the 6 months before Christmas. None of them celebrate anything to do with state or nation, though the first Monday in May was made a bank holiday by a recent Labour government as the British holiday in honour of working people. The most obvious and traditional British holiday destination is the coast. No place in the country is more than 3 hours' journey from some part of it. The coast is full of variety, with good cliffs and rocks between the beaches. But the uncertain weather and cold sea are serious disadvantages. Also, 2 weeks in a hotel room with balcony and private bath can now cost less in Spain or Greece, with flights included, than the same in a British hotel. Most of the hotels in the numerous seaside resort towns were built in the railway age, between 50 and 100 years ago, and seem not to be used as much by people going to conferences as by those on holiday. Going to a conference can be a sort of holiday, even in working time and with expenses paid.
1.
How long is the annual holiday for nearly all British full-time employees?
2. How many hours are there in a normal working week?
3. What does moonlighting refer to?
4. How many official public holidays are there in 1 year in Britain?
5. Which of the following is not a disadvantage for holidaymakers at a British seaside resort?